now for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Welcome in today to IUP TV. This is our streaming show. You're finding it, obviously, on our ABC 4 Plus News for Utah Plus. What is our app called, Peter?
News for Utah Plus.
Thank you.
ABC, nothing to do with it.
We're getting there.
We're off to a good start.
Strong start.
You know, some of us are human.
It's going to be a good show.
News for Utah Plus. You can find it on Fire TV, Roku, Samsung TV.
That's why producer Peter is here, because sometimes I need a little help. All right, News for Utah Plus.
Everywhere my parents will never see this.
That's right. We are glad you're here if you're 21 to 42. We appreciate you watching on your streaming service. Okay, joining us today, Taylor Morgan and Aaron Ryder. Tell us a little bit about who you are real quick.
I'm a partner at Morgan May Public Affairs. That is a local political consulting, lobbying, marketing firm.
Perfect.
I am a local attorney and also most recently the Republican nominee for Salt Lake County Mayor.
Perfect. So we've got lots to say, and you guys are both highly involved in local and obviously national politics as well. Okay, let's start with this. We haven't gathered since the Republicans held their state convention on Saturday. Chair Rob Axon reelected as the party's chair. This was seen as a showdown between Rob Axon and Phil Lyman. It was close vote, separated by about 135 votes. The delegates also yanked a proposal to strip party membership from signature gatherings. Candidates. That was really interesting to a lot of people. So just give me your hot takes real quick on what it means for the party going forward now that Rob has been reelected their chair.
I'll start really quickly. I was at convention and, you know, it was a lot less dramatic, I think, and a lot less controversial than many expected. Mm-hmm. I think many of the press, of course, not speaking for you, Lindsay Ehrens, but maybe others, many were expecting some real fireworks and some excitement, some drama, similar to what happened at the last Republican Party state convention in 2024.
Well, I think that's because Phil Lyman is very popular among the delegates.
He's popular among some.
Okay, some delegates. But he was a delegate winner in the 2024 election.
He was, yeah.
But you could attribute that to beating out Governor Spencer Cox, who is not super popular among the delegates, right? So those two are running against each other, and more of the delegate votes that went to Cox probably didn't go to Rob or some faction of that, right?
There's a lot of ways to look at it and break it down. I think it's important to remember that we're talking about a total pool of about 3,900, 4,000 state delegates in the Republican Party. About 65% of them attended. And so decent attendance for an organizing year convention. But again, it was a fairly efficient convention. Former Chair Thomas Wright was the hero of the day, I thought, getting through a very long agenda, managing those delegates trying to speak and make public comment and pass different amendments or resolutions or this or that. Thomas Wright kept that convention running on time.
Yeah,
and it ended early, actually.
For those who don't follow the intra-party politics, you know, and the party's processes.
Normal Utahns who have a life?
More?
Everyone.
Well, yeah. Yes. No, I didn't mean it that way. But just like, there are some quirks about the Republican convention. And one of those is that the delegates run the party, right? So every delegate at those conventions feels emboldened to get up and change rules and change the agenda, and then all the rest of the delegates vote on it. And to your point about Thomas Wright's credit, he was giving them that voice to say, this is your convention. They control the party, and so they feel emboldened in that.
But he also did a very good job of just moving things forward, because it's easy in that kind of environment where you get a lot of people who stand up, they want to talk forever and ever and debate issues. Mm-hmm. And then you get votes, you get motions to push a vote, you get motions to move things around on the agenda. And so having him be able to say, okay, well, now we're moving the amendments before the chair vote, which oftentimes you vote for party leaders or candidates first, then deal with the amendments. And usually by that time, people have left and you don't even have a quorum to deal with it.
Right.
So that's why they moved them ahead. But being able to move through that and to keep people's attention and to keep it moving all the way through, he does get a lot of credit for that. No question.
They did offer some food and Diet Coke for purchase at the convention.
Praise everyone. This is
they
this
learned
is the
from
biggest,
the 2024 convention.
They learned
convention.
From my tweets because I complain about it every year. Yeah. Every year we're there for 12 hours and there's no food to be found. They opened the concessions. There was Diet Coke abounding and burgers and chicken nuggets and all the things.
Yeah, so, I posted on X. I think this is the most significant thing
the
Republican Party has ever done to improve a state convention. So that was great. Can I make one quick point about attendance?
Please.
I did give delegates credit. 65% of all state delegates did attend, but the 35% who weren't there, that's a lot more significant, I think, because those folks don't just represent themselves and their vote. They represent every Republican voter in their precinct. They signed up and were elected to go to that convention, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. And because of that, hundreds of thousands of Utah Republicans had no voice on Saturday.
Producer Peter, I want to bring you in really fast here because I want you to disparage Taylor. No, I just want you to explain Taylor's conflict of interest here. Not necessarily conflict, but inherent bias because of who he is and what he does.
Peter?
So the viewers of this program should know that Morgan and May does work with Count My Vote, which in certain contexts can be oppositional to the convention system, if you find that to be a correct characterization.
Taylor is the reason we have the dual path to the ballot.
It's my fault.
Yep.
Yeah, SB 54 is Taylor's fault.
And I still serve as executive director of Count My Vote. So even more, Peter, than just my firm's work, it's me personally. So I do have that conflict and bias. And I still like Rob Axon, though. We're still friends.
Yeah.
And I do want to say real quick, too, about Rob Axon. I think that Rob has done a good job of straddling these two sides within the Republican Party because he is very conservative. He's a former Mike Lee staffer, and yet he is able to work with kind of all sides of the party. And I think that's what ultimately helped him win the nomination or win the chair seat again, because even people who may have liked Phil Lyman and supported Phil Lyman in the convention last year against Governor Cox looked at Rob and said, yeah, but he brought in a lot of money. Yeah. He's done good things for the party. And I think that Phil might not have that same mentality going into the chair position. I do think that mattered.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, before we leave this topic really quick, I wanted to disclose your bias because I want to just ask real quick for the fate of SB 54, given what happened at the convention on Saturday. Aaron, let me start with you, and then we'll let Taylor say what he knows.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I say this with Taylor sitting right here next to me, right?
Hey, it's all good.
That's why we have these discussions.
As a former candidate, it is really difficult to navigate this because if you choose to get signatures, which is a very valid path, it's a legal path to the ballot, you are punished by delegates. You are absolutely punished by delegates. But in a primary context, it's irrelevant. And usually the best candidate wins in the primary, even if whether they gather signatures or whether they go through convention. I would like to see a resolution to that. I don't know if it's going to happen realistically with Rob as chair. I think with Phil as chair, it might have happened, been easier. With Rob as chair, I just don't know that there's any incentive to really change the status quo. And that to me is unfortunate.
Taylor, I know you've said you've always, Count My Vote will defend the signature path virtually to the death. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you will defend the signature path. What do you see as the fate of SB 54?
Yeah, and it's not just about defending and preserving the signature path. It's about enhancing it. There are some issues. There are some things that we would like to improve that we've been working on for the last decade. Unfortunately, the state Republican Party has been fixated on kind of a zero-sum game of, undermining signatures as a way to prop up their failing caucus and convention process. They are not doing anything to improve caucuses or conventions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They've been entirely focused on hurting signature gathering instead. So I hope under Rob that the party will move forward in a constructive way. I think it would help if more people attended caucus and convention. The more voters, the more Republicans that participate in that, the more candidates get involved, and the better it reflects the majority of Utah Republicans. The problem is it's radicalized, it's extreme. It's a tiny pool of people that do not represent most Republicans.
Do you see the caucus convention system going away?
No, I don't see it going away. I think it is becoming less and less relevant every year because the party's not doing anything to improve it. For example, Governor Spencer Cox.
But is that
Spencer
not
Cox
a function of signatures being in place, though?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think it is for sure. But I also think, look at Salt Lake County last year in 2024. I've always said to people, if you really want to get rid of the signature gathering process, you've got to make sure that the caucus convention results actually match the primary results.
Yeah.
And so the Salt Lake County convention last year is the only convention where that happened. There was one race where the convention winner did not match the primary winner.
Yeah.
In every other race, it did. So if that's happening, there's no incentive to gather signatures. It's expensive, it's time consuming, it's difficult. But until then, when you have legitimate conservative candidates running for office, running for re-election, running as first-time candidates, and they're just getting penalized over and over and over again, it's a red herring argument. This is what frustrates me about this whole thing, is that as a candidate in Salt Lake County, the general election is what matters. But if the party only wants to focus on the fight happening at the primary level, the primary, how you get on the ballot, doesn't matter if you can't win the general election in November.
Yeah.
So we can have the debate, we can have the discussion, but instead of putting all of our effort in there, let's focus on getting the best candidates through, regardless of how they get through. If you want to strengthen the caucus convention, do it. But the emphasis needs to be the general election, not the fight over SB 54 in the primary.
Can't argue with that.
Okay, we will leave it there. Thank you both for your insights on that. We could talk all day about that because it's a topic the three of us really kind of know a lot about. Let's move on to this GRIT program that the governor recently announced. This is our producer, Peter. What does GRIT stand for?
Oh, geez.
Look it up.
Oh,
see,
wow.
He doesn't know either.
No. I think I've got it.
Government
reform, innovation, and transparency.
Transparency. I think you're right.
That.
All right, wow. I didn't have it written down, so I appreciate it. This is Utah's version of DOGE. Basically, uh-huh. The governor has gone to all of his agencies, state agencies, and said, you need to give me some plan here of whether you're going to cut anything or can you be more efficient or can your time improve? Just want your thoughts on how does this compare to DOGE? I mean, government efficiency is all the rage right now. It's the hot goss, right? Everyone's mm-hmm. talking about how they can make government more efficient.
I don't know if we're... Well, okay, we'll get to that later.
Are we doing it the right way, or is this a cut and slash type of thing that we're just going to see, you know, ramifications that are scary for government workers and for social services and stuff like that?
First of all, just from a marketing perspective, if you're just going to cash in on the political wins of DOGE, then use this same acronym, right?
Yeah, I think GRIT is silly.
Well, I said it here.
The governor didn't want to tie it to DOGE because he said that.
But if you don't want to tie it to DOGE, don't go there at all.
Well, we all kind of made the point that this is basically DOGE, right? But his point was that it is different because we're not just cutting and slashing. We're doing more targeted approaches, which is different.
And that may be true.
Yeah. So we're trying to cash in on the politics of DOGE, but also scared of getting in trouble with some voters for cashing in on the politics of DOGE.
Yeah, I frankly think this whole thing is kind of silly. And here's why. Governor Cox said in his press conference that we doge the legislative, like we doge, what did he say? Like we doge the,
we already do
the
this.
Budget like six times a year,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, if we're already
we doge
doing
the budget,
this,
see, it's a verb.
Right?
If we're already doing this, why name a total new initiative out of this? Why have a totally new initiative if you're not trying to, unless you're trying to cash in on DOGE itself? But I don't know that DOGE has been that popular or that effective. Like, I really don't know that DOGE has actually accomplished anything other than getting people to talk about it. And maybe that's enough, right? Maybe that's good enough. But if Utah's already doing this, then why not highlight what you're already doing? Why create a silly little acronym that is not at all the same word, even though it means basically the same thing?
Well, in defense of the acronym, GRIT is actually a program to get more girls involved in mountain biking. Shout out to Corner Canyon High School mountain bike team, the best team in the state.
But GRIT is
a program sponsored by NYCA National, youth mountain biking.
So they're getting
There's a real acronym there, and I don't appreciate Utah co-opting it.
Okay.
Yeah.
You can take that up with the governor.
I will.
It's interesting because I guess I'll pose this question to you guys too. Do we think Utah's government is lean enough? We have a $30.8 billion state budget. Granted, the 27% of that is for federal dollars, right? So the rest of that would be state dollars. Do we have a lean enough government? Should we be doing more to cut it?
Okay, I'm actually going to rephrase your question a little bit. I think if Governor
Please
Cox...
Please woman-splain it to me, Erin.
I'm going to woman-splain this to you. If Governor Cox is trying to do this through the lens of what it stands for, right? Reform, innovation, what was the other one?
Transparency.
I'm fine with that. Like, that's kind of what DOGE was supposed to do initially. DOGE ended up becoming synonymous with cuts and firing people. But I don't know that that was totally... That was the whole point of DOGE. If GRIT can do that, maybe innovation is where they end up focusing. Maybe they're looking at new ways of doing things. Do I think we have room to cut? Probably. Our taxes are still kind of high in the state of Utah. It'd be nice if they weren't, right? For all that we claim to be a Republican state, and we have all these great things about our state, we still have some high taxes here. So I think there is room for looking at ways to do things better. But if we're looking at reform, innovation, transparency, maybe that's a different emphasis than just simply slashing and burning.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with most of that, Aaron. I really do. I think Utah's government is pretty efficient already. We do a good job. We balance our budget. We're required to constitutionally. I also would like to see our state income tax come down or actually go away altogether.
How do we fund education if we do that?
Well, we have to pass a constitutional amendment to change that before we can. That's a key point. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. We'll watch and see what happens. Let's switch to some national politics because these are always talkers. One of the big talkers of the week was that the Pentagon has officially accepted a jet from the Qatar government, the Qatari government, however you want to say it. And I was told that there's no right way to say it because the letters in Arabic don't exist in English. So we can all say it however we feel like.
Okay. Yeah. So Qatar. Liberating.
So, yeah, it's you're not saying it wrong.
For like a decade.
Is it Qatar? Yeah. Is it Qatar? Is it, yeah. Yeah,
and people correct you aggressively.
Totally.
People have strong opinions about that.
Very. Yeah. So the Qatari jet, however it is being said, is coming here from the government. Trump is defending this, saying, why should taxpayers pay for a Air Force One type of plane when we can get it for free?
We're already paying for the oil.
Obviously,
right? They're taking our money. We might as well get a jet for it.
Obviously, the optics of this are very bad. We've had some Democrats call for this is a violation of the Constitution. Foreign governments cannot accept gifts.
Is there anything that isn't a violation of the Constitution, according to Democrats? That's all they got.
Stop violating the Constitution, and maybe there won't be.
Okay. Hey, what kind of a plane is it? Peter, what kind of a plane is it? Do we know?
Oh, I could find the model here for you real quick.
But we know who made it, don't we?
Yeah. I want to say American it was manufactured made? In Qatar. I will double check this, but I know one of the concerns that had been listed is because it was manufactured outside the supervision of the Department of Defense, they are going to have to potentially take this thing apart and just make sure it's not bugged.
Scan it for
bugs. Make sure there's not security flaws just because they didn't make it.
Yeah.
So that could become a cost that's passed on to the taxpayer. ABC has a report on that. I will find that for y'all real quick.
Okay, so what is the justification for taking this plane? Clearly we know where Trump feels with it. Why is this okay?
I have no justification for this. I think it's just bad on every possible level because you have the security risks like we were just talking about. But also if we have this whole thing about, you know, made in America, I don't know, maybe this plane was made in America, but sent to a foreign government. Like we're trying to bring everything back in-house, everything back into the country. And we're going to take the plane that carries the president from another country. Like that's the angle we're going to go for this. I don't know. I think this idea that, taxpayers don't have to pay for it. Well, then what? We have to pay for all the tariffs that you're going to impose? Like, I don't know. I don't buy that argument, right? I think it's convenient. And the fact that it attaches to Trump's presidential library down the road also, I think, bothers me. Apparently.
Really?
Yeah, apparently there are planes in presidential libraries.
Yes, they're in Ronald Reagan's presidential library in Simi Valley. I'm not actually sure. I haven't been to a lot of libraries. I'd like to, but I have seen one there.
Do they have the plane just like outside the library?
They have it actually inside a building. It's protected inside a large glass not warehouse, but right, a building, and you can go in it and tour it. It's very cool.
Did Reagan use it after his presidency?
I don't know. That is a fact for Peter. Yeah, we'll
find
out.
Peter, you can look that up. Because, you know, if
he's
Trump is
currently looking up the last thing.
Sorry. If I can jump in with an update from that, it is a Boeing 747.
An American-made plane.
Which was, of course, an American company. Yes.
There you go. I'm okay with this. I am okay with the plane. And in part because we have to pick our battles with President Trump. There are a lot of things to be upset about. This is not one. This is not even in the top 100 of issues to fixate on with Donald Trump maybe behaving poorly. It's a plane. It's a Boeing. We'll sweep it for bugs. He'll take it, maybe use it, put it in the presidential library. But I'm not paying for it. And I'm okay. I'm all right with that.
Does it come with any questions of his indebtedness to Qatar now?
Did we have any questions about that already? I mean, do we think Donald Trump is going to suddenly change his position relative to Qatar because of the plane? I don't think so. I think he has that position anyway.
If you were offered $1,000 and a steak dinner, wouldn't that indebt you a little bit to the person who offered you the steak dinner?
But if I already have the $1,000 in steak dinner and I'm just getting more of it, it doesn't change
how I act. I think it's a chicken and egg argument, right? Maybe he got the plane because he was already friendly to Qatar. But I don't know that that changes the argument. Like, you're still friendly to a country. Do we want to be friendly to them? I don't know. Like, where do we stand with some of this stuff? And for me, it's the precedent. It's what do we do? You know, it's the foreign gift concept. Like, and do we really want the plane that's carrying the president to be a gift from a Middle Eastern country? I don't know.
I'm okay with it. I don't know. I mean, really, Donald Trump will accept the plane and then he will literally invade Qatar if he wants to. Donald Trump is true. Not predictable. We cannot guess what this man is going to do or say. So, you know, I'm okay.
Do you think we see it challenged further on the violation of the Constitution potential?
Democrats have nothing better to do.
I don't. It's a waste. This is where I'll agree with Taylor. It's a waste of time to challenge it in court. There are too many other battles already going through the court system to challenge. I don't like it. I think it's concerning, but I don't think it's going
to
go anywhere.
There's a lot of money to be made right now in Washington, D.C. if you are a progressive constitutional attorney. A lot of money, a lot of hours.
Yeah, interesting.
If I may inject one last little bit of context, Reagan's plane that is displayed in the Presidential Library in California was in service as Air Force One for 28 years. Several presidents, of course, used it before President Reagan. It was retired before H.W. Bush took office. And then started living at the Reagan Presidential Library, I should say, in 2004. So I don't believe Reagan used it post-presidency. It remained in possession of the Air Force.
Okay.
Okay.
Good to know. We've all been educated today. Okay, let's switch to the Big Beautiful Bill. As we record this show right now, the Big Beautiful Bill has passed the House by one vote because there was one Republican who voted present and one Republican who basically sailed this thing through the House. And sailed is the wrong word, but got this thing through the House. It passed by one. One
Eked,
vote is not
maybe.
Sailing. Yeah. Eking, squeaking, narrowly passing through the House. Trump kind of got in there and flexed his political muscle with Republicans saying, here's how we should do this, get this thing passed. What do you think the fate of this thing is as it heads to the Senate?
It's going to change.
Yeah, again, the Big Beautiful Bill cuts spending $1.7 billion, something to
but
that effect.
Adds, but it adds $4 trillion to the deficit.
Yeah, to the deficit. Right. And
or
raises
the debt. Sorry, the debt.
Yeah, the debt ceiling. So where does it go from here?
Yeah, it changes. The Senate has already said that they're going to look at it. They're going to review it. So for me, it's almost like I don't know that there's that much to say about it now because it's going to change. And Mike Johnson's going to have to work with the Senate to actually get this thing through because this really is a test for Mike Johnson more than anybody on the Senate side, more than anybody else in the House. This is Mike Johnson's test. And if he can't get this thing passed, then that's going to be a real blow to his time as speaker, to Trump's agenda, the whole thing. So this is all coming down to Mike Johnson. And he climbed one hurdle. He got it through the House. It was a battle. They were able to pull it off. But now he's got to get it through the Senate.
And to that point, I asked Senator John Curtis about what would happen with the Big Beautiful Bill. Keep in mind, this was on Saturday of this week before it had passed the House, when it was still in limbo of will it come back in a House committee? So lots happened since Saturday in politics, right? Things change by the hour sometimes.
Much like the House, we have people arguing for more cuts, less cuts. And I think we will greatly respect what's sent to us from the House, but we'll have a mind of our own as well. And you'll probably see some differences coming out of the Senate. Many people are committed to not take benefits away from those who are vulnerable or who need them. At the same time, we all know there's a vast number of people on these rolls that are taking advantage of these benefits and should be working.
Okay, so they're kind of his views on Medicaid and that's what's in this bill and whether people are taking advantage of the system. And then you heard him say the Senate has a mind of its own and it will do its own thing, kind of to your point. So
one other thing I want to add is that the big fight with this and one really important piece for Republicans is how they handle the Medicaid debate because Democrats are already preparing to use this against Republicans in the midterms. Mm-hmm. And if Republicans are smart, they'll be able to navigate that messaging well. If Democrats are smart, maybe this gives them enough of a comeback to retake at least the House, maybe even the Senate, but more likely the House. And that's going to really block President Trump's ability to do anything for his remaining 2 years. So there's a lot writing on this, not just the bill itself, but how this thing is messaged, how they actually go through with these cuts is going to have pretty big impacts on the midterms.
Do we think that the people who are using Medicaid who shouldn't be on it, to Senator Curtis's point, is that the issue with Medicaid? Did we get it right?
Work requirements, right? I think it centers around the work requirements. And I want to give Speaker Mike Johnson a lot of credit for getting it through the House by one vote, right?
It's a tough job.
There, you know, if they can come to a compromise and agreement with the Senate in a conference committee, then it's possible this could pass. Mike Johnson, I think, will be the hero,
ultimately,
if it does succeed. Yeah.
One thing that really matters to Utah, I'll just note that we took out the piece that would have sold off some public lands here in Utah. We have yet to hear from Representative Celeste Malloy, who was the backer of this amendment, on why that happened. So you two can speculate on why you think it happened, but we don't have time to do that. So just give me your thoughts on how significant that is.
I mean, in that part of the state, in southern Utah, this debate rages on. It just absolutely rages on. And people have very strong opinions on both sides of this. I'm not surprised to see it come out. Anytime any proposal comes up regarding public land in southern Utah, it gets batted around, and ultimately things tend to just kind of stay where they are.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, 70% of Utah's federal land. And a great portion of that, we're not talking national parks or national monuments. We're talking BLM land. We're talking about a ton of public, federally owned land, millions of acres within existing municipal city limits that can and, frankly, must be developed in order for Utah to continue its growth. We're the fastest growing, youngest state in the country. We have to have access to some of these federal lands.
Okay, we'll see where it goes from there. Taylor Morgan with Morgan & May Public Affairs and Aaron Ryder, local attorney. Appreciate you guys joining me today to break this all down. And, of course, we'll be back with our next show here on our News for Utah Plus app.